Hello and welcome. Tonight we're going to transition from our previous lecture on state security regulation onto federal securities regulation. If you remember, with state regulation, you have the Blue Skies Law. And what these laws try to do is make sure that anyone who purchases securities, stocks or bonds, a corporation, that they know what they're buying, that they know the financial position of the corporation, that they know the activities and what the corporation does. If it makes widgets, what kind of widgets does it make? What are its long-term goals and planning? The Blue Skies Law opens up disclosure, provides for registration, and provides for enforcement if a corporation is hiding something. Under New York State, the Blue Sky Law is known as the Martin Act, passed in 1921. The most powerful, broad-based Blue Sky Law in the nation, one of the first. It is a model for the country. The Office of the New York State Attorney General is the enforcer. They're the regulator under the Martin, and have been very aggressive. And because New York State is the home of the New York State Stock Exchange, it is particularly relevant because that Blue Sky Law applies to all those transactions as well. Tonight, we're going to talk about federal regulation. And whereas state regulation is very broad-based, as long as the transaction has some nexus with New York State, federal regulation is more limited. And we'll discuss all of that. Generally, each state in the United States has its own Securities Act, as we discussed under state regulation. These are known as Blue Skies Laws. They regulate the offer and sale of securities. In New York State, that Blue Sky Law is the Martin Act. Under federal law, there are federal laws that also apply to securities transactions and protect the public from the sale of fraudulent securities. There's four principal laws that provide this framework, and they are the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, and the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. Now, you'll notice that first two are part of FDR's New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt was the president during the Great Depression after the stock market crashed in 1929. He was the one who pushed through Congress this new federal regulation. As we talked about before, he had the Martin Act at his disposal when he was governor of New York back in 1929 when the stock market crash happened. And did not use that, but instead used the clarion call that the stock market crash needed federal laws, because FDR was very much of a federalist. He wanted the federal government involved on it. Interestingly enough, he did not use the Martin Act, and even though that was under the purview of the Attorney General, he was governor at the time, but he wanted to bring the Martin Act-like laws to the United States, and he did in the Great Depression, 33 and 34, 33 being the first year of his term. Now, remember, the Martin Act has a very broad definition of security. Well, so does the Securities Act of 1933, the first act that was passed. It was passed in the first year of Roosevelt's term. It means any note, stock, treasury stock, security future, security base swap, bond, debenture, evidence of indebtedness, certificate of interest, participation, profit sharing agreement, collateral trust certificate, and it goes on and on and on. Well, basically what we need to know for this class, and pretty much what you need to know for life, dealing with a corporation, it's any stock or bond issued by a corporation. These derivative products are basically derivatives of the stocks and bonds. At the end of the day, they're covered too under this definition. Now, as we said, the very first securities law at the federal level was the Securities Act of 1933. It was enacted by Congress in accordance with the Interstate Commerce Clause. And that was a subject of legal debate at that time when it was first enacted, because the federal government had never delved into the management of the United States economy. Roosevelt came dedicated to doing that because of the Great Depression and wanted to react to the problems that were going on in the country at the time. Hence, one of the things that everybody looked at was, hey, the stock market crash helped bring on the Great Depression, a lot of people thought. And as a result, we need to have greater transparency on stock transactions. So they passed this Securities Act of 1933. It was one of the New Deal reforms to react to that stock market crash. It was designed to be compatible with blue sky laws. Now remember, Roosevelt comes out of New York, he's governor of New York. He doesn't want to eviscerate or replace the Martin Act, because it, as we said in our state regulation, it is the most powerful securities laws in the country. And Congress wouldn't give him all the powers of the Martin Act. So what he does is he says, we're going to have dual regulation. We're going to have regulation on top of the regulation. You're going to have the state have the ability to do it, but we're also going to allow the federal government to do it too. So we're going to have an interlaced system of regulation whereby both the state blue sky laws together with the Securities Act work together to provide belts and suspenders and double regulation. It wanted, and its whole purpose was to have accurate disclosure information concerning the security traded. What is the financial position of the corporation issuing the stock? What is the corporation doing? What does it sell? What kind of sales does it have over the last several years? What is its projections? And who is on its board? All of those issues become disclosure. And what the 1933 Act does is it says, listen, we're going to make sure that every person who wants to buy stocks or bonds gets this information. And it requires that every one of the corporations provides a registration statement, which lists all these things that are important. Now, when the 33 Act was passed, they registered with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and it required what they call this prospectus, which is this disclosure document, to be provided to every purchaser of stock. Or bonds with respect to this. And the FTC oversaw that, but they only oversaw it for about a year and a few months, because later on, the next act, and this is a registration statement for the 33 Act, which helps you kind of understand what you have to provide. But in 1934, you have a new act, and the FTC gets replaced by the Securities and Exchange Commission. They create an absolutely separate regulator only for securities, 1934. Now, the 33 Act is very important, because the 33 Act basically says everything that you have to disclose. As you can see from this registration statement, there's quite a bit that you have to disclose in order to be able to transact those stocks. Now, this does not apply to everybody. The 33 Act did not apply unless you were trading on an exchange. So if you're part of the New York Stock Exchange, you have to follow all this. but there's a lot of exceptions to the 33 Act, and we'll get to them. Under Regulation A, you have a simplified registration for small businesses. So if you're not one of, if you're not Microsoft and you're instead Fred's Computer Company, and write a specified piece of software for a specified niche market, and you only have 100 employees, you're allowed to have a simplified registration statement, because it's unfair to make a very small business do the same work as a mega $1 billion business. And Regulation D also provides similar exemptions to allow for small businesses to have access to capital markets, because that's what stocks do. You sell shares in the company in order to raise capital. Now, Rule 506, which is another exception under the Securities Act of 1933, allows for private placements. This is where it's not offered to the general public as a whole, that it's only offered to a targeted group of people, and that private placement is not required to have the same level of registration, the same level of disclosure. Why? Because this is being done to very sophisticated investors who have been selected and who want to do this. And as a result of that, that is given a little bit more of a leeway with respect to all these regulations. And also, limited offerings. It provides that you need not register and provide the same registration information if the issuance is less than $1 million in securities in any 12-month period. So if you're only trying to raise $1 million, that's different than the multi-billion dollar Microsofts or Googles or Facebooks on there. So they're given to it. A limited offering on that is provided somewhat limitations on this, and it's not as heavy a regulation. This also allows for it, if it's less than $5 million, to no more than 35 non-accredited investors in any 12 months. So it's got those thresholds in it, and that's basically said, you're not looking to raise a ton of money. Now, to you and me, $5 million is a lot, but to a corporation trying to do business, it's really not. So those are limited offerings, private placements, small business concerns. Those do not have to have the same registration as the big ones. And the big ones, you're required to know everything about it. And the 33 Act, as we said, is rather significant, and it requires significant disclosure so that you have informed investors. And it imposes, if you don't follow the rules, civil liability upon an offeror for making false or misleading or not disclosing in their statements or admitting a material fact in those statements that the SEC views as important. You're going to be civilly fined for that. Okay. The 34 Act comes into play the next year, and they realize that the Federal Trade Commission is not the appropriate entity. It was all that they had in 33, but by 34, they broaden these security regulations, and they create an entity to be able to oversee it. That's a dedicated, the Federal Trade Commission were doing other things. They wanted a dedicated regulator who had experience in nothing but securities, and that becomes the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they're the ones who oversee the 34 Act and the 33 Act together. They're the ones that are the regulators. They're the ones who put out these regulations. organizations are the ones who look over these disclosure statements and these registrations. In addition to the change of who's the regulator on it, they also provide for a broadening of the registration, and then it goes to exchanges, brokers, and dealers. So it's not just a corporation who's doing it. They also expand it to those people who are trading in these outside third-party stocks. And as a result of that, this federal securities regulation has an interlaced target of having its own separate regulator in going from the Federal Trade Commission to now Securities and Exchange Commission. Since 1934, the SEC, it's called, now oversees all of this. They're a dedicated regulator to securities, and they're the enforcer of all these federal laws. Now, that was the law up until 2002. It was amended throughout the course as these financial products changed. But until 2002, you had the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 34. But in 2002, you had a very large financial scandal. It was known as WorldCom and Enron, and it was after that a lot of investors were defrauded, what they did was they strengthened the federal securities laws basically by an act of Congress known as Sarbanes-Oxley. It's named after its two sponsors, Michael Oxley and Senator Paul Sarbanes, and this law established new standards and enhanced standards for the United States public company boards, its management, its public accounting firms. What this tried to do, whereas the 33 and 34 acts tried to provide improved disclosure by means of registration statements, this act tried to improve the quality of the disclosure. What it wanted to try and do is make sure that the information disclosed in those registration statements was more accurate and more reflective of what was going on. The act, Sarbanes-Oxley, contains 11 titles and deals with not only corporate governance and corporate board responsibilities, and it provides for criminal penalties for fraud. And it is under this basis, it also requires a certification of those registration statements that have to be filed with the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer. Serious penalties are imposed under this act, including $1 million in fines and 10 years in prison for knowing misrepresentation, $5 million in fines and 20 years in prison for a willful, that's purposeful and intentional misrepresentation. After the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, Congress again went back and passed the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, whereas it hadn't done anything for a period of about 80 years. It came in and started doing it in 2002 and 2010. And the reason why it was doing that was because of the fact that you had these financial crises that were occurring, pretty much regular swings in the economy, but Congress wanted to show it was responsive, and it passed this Dodd-Frank Act, which is pretty much uniformly viewed as doing more harm than good. And a lot of it has been repealed. Some of it has been altered. Some of it has been kept. And it's still on the books today in many respects, and we'll go through that. Basically, what it tries to do, and this is named after its sponsors as well, Barney Frank, who was a congressman from Massachusetts, and Christopher Dodd, who was a senator from Connecticut. Yeah, it establishes new requirements on capital investment by banks and insurance companies, added regulation on hedge funds and private equity funds, and it provides for new updated definition of accredited investors, and it requires issues like how people get paid within corporations. It does a lot of invasive type of micromanagement, particularly in the banking area, which has generally been seen as counterproductive and ineffective. Despite the fact that there was problems, and that's what this was targeted at, to a large degree, commentators since this has been passed 10 years ago have said it's actually hurt the economy and not done what its intent was in many respects with respect to this micromanaging of corporate operations, particularly the banks and the insurance field. It is created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, known as the CFPB, which has been extremely controversial, particularly under its previous management with Richard Corday, who was refused to be confirmed by the United States Senate because he was taking this entity, it was a recess appointment, and he was using it, which means that the President of the United States appoints him and doesn't need confirmation because he's only appointed for a short period of time. But Richard Corday did all kinds of things whereby he was going beyond the scope of the statute, and this CFPB got a very bad reputation within the financial markets and most economists. Today, it is under new leadership and is trying to get back to the original intent of the statute and has become less controversial over that period. But it has basically been reviled by financial markets and investors. Now, the purpose of federal securities regulation is the same as the purpose of state financial regulation. And what they did was they wanted anti-fraud provisions. They wanted disclosure. Both blue sky laws and these federal acts require registration whereby the corporation goes in and provides all the information regarding its company. The Securities Exchange Commission is the regulator under federal law, whereas the regulator under state laws, the State Attorney General in New York under the Martin Act. Now recognize, we just talked about the CFPB, that is more of a consumer entity. It doesn't really regulate the federal securities laws that was left and retained by the SEC. But what they do is they intercede on behalf of consumers, the people who are buying stock or the people who are buying the products as a result of this, and issue penalties for fraud on that basis. So the Securities and Exchange Commission is still the principal regulator with respect to federal securities laws. That CFPB comes in as kind of a public advocate, if you will. That's one of the reasons why the financial markets and the corporations across the country hate it so much. Whereas they work with the SEC, they understand the mission of the SEC, and they view that as their regulate. Penalties for fraud under federal security laws are substantial. And just like in the state blue sky laws, fraudulent statements, as well as other acts of fraud or deception or concealment are given substantial penalties as a result of this. There's two regulations that I wanted to point out here. Rule 10b-5, which is a provision, it's a regulation relating to the 1934 Securities and Exchange Act. And That is the principal anti-fraud rule. It applies to all private security actions. It expressly provides you have liability not only for fraud, but also for material misrepresentation or omissions. Fraud is a material misrepresentation, whereas an omission goes beyond fraud, and Rule 10b-5 covers both of them. So if you leave something out as well, you have that. Misrepresentation is where you mischaracterize or lie about something, where if you just are silent frequently, that was not covered. Today it is under 10b-5, where if you leave it out and you're supposed to have it in, that can subject you to penalties too. And lastly, I want to talk about the Williams Act, that the SEC, under the authority of this act, regulates cash tender offers. And the securities industry provides arbitration procedures under this act to resolve disputes between customers. And those arbitration procedures have proven highly effective. The Williams Act has been very heralded amongst the investment community. Now, one of the last things I want to hit on is insider trading. Because this has become a very serious issue. Insider trading is where someone with knowledge of what's going on before the securities transaction cannot use that action, that knowledge, in order to make money or prevent themselves from losing money. To give you an example, corporate directors and corporate employees and corporate officers are typically viewed as insiders. So if you know that the company is going to come out with a new Apple Watch, you can't invest in Apple stock knowing that this is going to be a rollout next week. Why? You have inside information on it. You know it's going to happen. This is also true with consultants and attorneys and CPAs. You're a CPA for the company. You know that this rollout is coming. You can't invest in that stock. Or if you know that a really bad problem is coming in, that Apple Watch that's being rolled out is going to fail because its software program's got glitches, you can't dump all your stock. Why? Because you have this inside information. So if someone receives information from an insider, that person will be liable because you're breaching a fiduciary duty not only to the corporation, but also to its investors. One of the biggest insider trading cases in many years was that of Martha Stewart. Martha Stewart was a very accomplished, she started out in the 1960s as a model, a very pretty woman, and she built an empire regarding her home economics type of activity. She had a line of cooking lines domestic products like sheets and curtains and things of that nature, and became a very heralded person in this field. Her name on her products would allow her to sell them for a lot higher value because of the fact that everybody knew and trusted her advice and her style and her suggestions on that. But one day she knew that her company was going to end up having a serious problem down the road and dumped all of her stock. And as a result of that, she avoided a loss of $45,000 because she knew that her company was going to have that and dumped her stock. And the day after she did this, the stock value fell 16%. And the federal government looked at this and said, Martha Stewart, you may be a very accomplished, wonderful lady, but you used your inside information illegally, and you cannot do insider trading. And that's not only to buy stock with inside information knowing it's going to make money, but it's also to sell stock knowing that it's going to lose money after you sell it. And in a very high profile case, one of the biggest trials in recent history, the jury convicted her of conspiracy and lying to investigators. And in a very short period of time, she went to jail. She went to jail for 5 months. One last wrap up with respect to, there's some miscellaneous provisions within federal securities laws and misappropriation. That's when a person with a fiduciary duty steals information in order to trade in securities. It's kind of like insider trading. You're not an insider, but you're getting that information. And as a result, you can be held as if you are an insider because you misappropriate that information. There is required disclosure by directors and officers of corporations. Regulation F through K requires that companies disclose business experience of their directors and officers and nominees as well. This disclosure statements are required by corporate directors and officers owning equity securities. So if officer or director is heavily invested in the corporation, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing because you want your directors to have a belief in your company. And one of the ways they can do that, they can put their money where their mouth is. But you want to know what they have. And if they are totally running and controlling the corporation, you want to know that. And it's a disclosure issue, not a prohibition. You also want to know who are the top 10% shareholders, because those are the people who get to elect the board of directors. Those top 10% shareholders in the corporation have a lot more clout, because remember, one vote per stock share. So if you own 10% of the company, you get 10% of the votes, and that's quite a few. So you have to disclose on that. And any people who are selling their securities for profit less than 6 months after buying them, you want to know about that. And as a result of that, if they're flipping these over so fast for a short swing profit, as it's called, you have to disclose that. Also, one last thing on Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley really went after not only corporations, but also their accountants. There was a lot of issues with respect to the accountants should have caught what happened in WorldCom, what happened in Enron, and it was really targeted at them to a large degree. And as a result of this, accountants are now required to have a substantial disclosure in addition to the officers and the directors and the corporation itself. They're required to have periodic job roll-off, which means the same accountant can't be on the same job for a period of time. They figured that that was too cozy a relationship. The firm can, but the accountant itself has to be changed. And it also provides for what we called accountant discipline, meaning they can discipline an accountant by suspension or disbarment if they're a lawyer on accountants who violate the securities laws. That's all we have for this. We're going to move on to industry self-regulation next time. Can't wait to talk about it. Thanks so much.